Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
The Disruption Zone. Joining us today on today's episode is Congressman Andy Barr. And there's so much to talk about with regards to what's going on with the coronavirus. Congressman, welcome. How are you, sir?
Hey, Leland. How are you? Hope you're healthy. And, you know, this is a crazy time right now.
It is indeed. I'm bunkered down in my basement studio, so everything is good. We're all set. But you know, there's a lot of people like our first line workers who don't have that option. Our nurses, our doctors, the people that are keeping our grocery store shelves stocked, those folks, they don't have the luxury of working from a home office or something. So prayers go out to them for sure.
Absolutely. Shout out to them, the police officers, the paramedics, the grocery store clerks, obviously the people who are on the front lines, the healthcare workers, the nurses, the doctors. But I'll tell you, there's other people who are really helping too, like the county clerk's offices, the workers who are processing all these new loans, and the bank tellers. These are essential workers to keep this economy going during this shutdown, and hats off to them.
I'm actually absolutely in awe of my garbage man. He's my new hero.
Yeah.
I'm like,
absolutely.
He doesn't know what's in that trash can. I'm like, that guy's my hero. That dude is a warrior right there. So
absolutely. And hats off. And my 9-year-old daughter just came downstairs, and hats off to the teachers who are doing the remote teaching online too. Thanks for that.
Yeah. You know what? I had a conversation. I don't want to go too far down a rabbit trail, but since you brought it up, one of our upcoming episodes is with Drew Curtis. I don't know if you know him or not. He ran as an independent for governor a couple of years ago and owns FARC.com. And he was mentioning the remote learning in Woodford County. And it was kind of interesting because he said that one of the ways that they've been able to function is that, you know, you basically do your work, and if the kid needs to, this is maybe one of the silver linings coming out of this whole thing. You do your work, and a kid who needs help sort of raises their hand digitally. The rest just keep going. I was raised, my parents founded a private Christian school on an Indian reservation in Arizona using a curriculum called ACE, which is called, it means Accelerated Christian Education. The way that system worked was you went by your own self-pace, and then when you needed help, you raised your hand. So the attention in the classroom only went to the students who needed it, while the others continue to pace. What that did for me, where I struggled greatly with math and some of the sciences, but I excelled in communications, English, and social studies, I finished all of that stuff I excelled at early, and then I could focus on the other thing. I wonder if we might learn something about how to educate kids through all of this with that flexibility and how teachers are learning and picking up new ways of teaching because of the remoteness. I don't know. Maybe it's a silver lining, right?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of silver linings in this. I mean, I think we're rebalancing our whole lives right now.
Yeah.
Whether it's an education, our spirituality, mm-hmm. I think we're reconnecting with our families. I mean, certainly that's the case with me personally. I'll just be personal about this. I mean, my routine is so often I'm going to D.C. I'm in Washington, D.C., and I'm not, you know, at home with my kids as much. And it's, you know, the silver lining for me is, man, it's awesome because I get to be home with my girls.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the case with a lot of people. Obviously this is not good.
Right.
This is bad for a lot of people for health reasons. It's bad for people because of the economics and their financial distress and they don't have a paycheck. But you know, if you're gonna make the most out of this, let's reconnect with our families.
Yeah. And you mentioned spirituality as well. I mean, I think what's cool is I did a program with a pastor friend of mine who is finding new ways to sort of branch out and reach his congregation. And we were talking about the sheer numbers of people that are actually coming to church digitally that never maybe would have ever set foot or darkened the door of a four-walled church. And there's like, you know, there's this moment when you have something like this facing our society, where whether you get this virus or not, And most of us will not get it, or most of us who do get it will not feel it. But you still know it's out there, and you still know it's doing terrible things to some people. It forces you to face your own mortality. And when we see this sort of false materialistic world that we've built over the last, you know, so many decades, literally come crumbling down in the matter of a second over a thing so tiny we can't even see it until we have a microscope, it forces you to stop and take stock of what our place in the universe really is, how vulnerable we are, as you know, and look to a higher power.
Exactly. And I tell you what, I see so much hope. I see so much optimism. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a time in our lives where we can really lean on our faith. And I think people who do have faith, I think people who, I mean, I am personally a Christian. And so I think people who are Christians and who are, you know, going to church online, I think that's a real blessing, frankly, right. in this whole, you know, difficult stage of our lives. This is the silver lining that we might have a bit of a reawakening,
right,
spiritually in our country. And, you know, I think the country on the back end, and I try to be an optimist, I think on the back end, our public health system will be more resilient because of the steps that we are taking. And frankly, our economy, I think, because of all of the fiscal stimulus and the heroic work that's being done to help businesses, I think if we can reopen the economy sooner rather than later, I really do think that there could be a powerful recovery. I think if this goes on for a long time, it'll be more difficult. But I hope on the back end, we will be a stronger country spiritually, economically, and in terms of our healthcare system.
I agree. I think it's, you know, this is a place, a fork in the road, so to speak. You know, we could take one of two paths. I think that, you know, there's a lot of people, a lot of my friends on the left are going, look at you guys on the right that are all supporting getting paychecks from the government. And I'm like, no, that's not exactly what's happening here. We're, you know, these stimulus checks that are going out, the people that are now without a salary, the people that are now with their business shuttered, who have invested everything in what they started, everything in what they built, they didn't choose to shut their doors. The government told them to. Albeit for a good reason, but the government told them to. This is not because they made a series of decisions that were bad business decisions and the government's bailing them out. This is an entirely different thing. The fact that the economy is completely shut off right now is the government's responsibility because they told us to do it. And so that changes how you look at the stimulus.
Totally right, Leland. I mean, 3 points here. Number one, the economy was booming before this happened. I mean, the unleashing of free enterprise gave us the best economy in 50 years. And the only thing that could have disrupted it was this, which was a unforeseen pathogen that killed the economy. Number two is that this is not a recession in the traditional sense of the word. This is a government-imposed, government-created, government-intentionally created shutdown of the economy.
Right.
The government is telling Americans to quit working. The government is telling businesses to shut down, and for a good reason, for a public health emergency. But this is not a recession. This is the government intentionally shutting down wide swaths of the economy. And so the government owes the American people, kind of like the way to think of this, Leland, in my opinion, is kind of like eminent domain.
Right.
The government has taken economic prosperity away from the American people, albeit for a good reason, but they have taken their property away from them, their livelihood, their paychecks. And so the government owes people, you know, compensation for that. So that is totally different than what we've seen in prior recessions or the financial crisis.
Right.
This is the government that has done this to the American people. The government owes the American people compensation for that. So it's totally different than the financial crisis in that sense. And the final thing is, look, I mean, the private sector is on full display. The innovation, the thank God for the blessing of private enterprise in this crisis, because if it wasn't for free enterprise and private enterprise, we would be in real trouble. Mm-hmm. It's the banks, it's the credit unions that are delivering, that we have delegated the lending to the private sector in this stimulus. Can you imagine if we put the responsibility of lending and bridging the gap to the government in this situation? It's hard enough as it is, but we had the wisdom in this bill to delegate the responsibility to the banking and the credit unions and the community banks and the private sector to get this cash flow and liquidity out into the economy. That's a good thing. The other thing is, look at the pharmaceutical industry. Look at the private sector, the innovation, the scientists. It is the private sector of the American free enterprise system that is going to save humanity in this situation. It's not the government. The government is getting out of the way. 20 emergency use authorizations from the FDA because the Trump administration has unleashed the bureaucracy. Right. They have said to the bureaucracy, stand down. They have said to the bureaucrats, stand down. Don't get in the way. Let the American scientists, innovators, and the pharmaceutical professionals solve the problem. The American people are going to save the world because of our free enterprise system, because of the private sector. So to all of the people on the left who think that this is the moment of government, you're wrong. You're totally wrong.
Right.
This is the moment of freedom, the moment of free enterprise, where we actually can unleash the innovation and the creativity of the American people. They will solve the problems that are confronting the human race right now.
Yeah, totally agree. Well said. Speaking of bureaucracy, and was talking to Josh Crawford from the Pegasus Institute just a couple of days ago, and I said, thank God we had a president who was deregulating for 3 years prior to this, because that sort of smoothed the wheels a little bit. But on the other hand, there are still weird ways that bureaucracy gets in the way of this stuff as well. Last night on Twitter, I tweeted out that bureaucracy always equates funding with results, yet they rarely get results with the funding, regardless of how much they get. Then if there's a cut, however small, they blame whatever non-results they have on the lack of funding. A perfect example of that is the CDC. The CDC was not prepared for this. The president came in and saw that there was a lot of things going on at the CDC that didn't really have to do with disease, and he cut their budget. And now the CDC is blaming the president for this virus outbreak. Couldn't be farther from the truth. The CDC has one job. They're not supposed to be studying whether or not if somebody shoot somebody with a gun, if that's a disease. They're supposed to be preparing for pandemics. You know, there are ways in which the bureaucracies get in the way of themselves and in the way of sometimes solving these problems. I think a perfect example affecting Kentucky is one you're working on in a bipartisan manner with your colleague John Yarmuth, which that's funny to see you two standing shoulder to shoulder, but trying to get the FDA off the back of the distilleries in Kentucky who are trying to make sanitizer for our first-line workers.
That's right. And it's not just the FDA, it's the IRS. I mean, fortunately, a couple of weeks ago, I called Kevin Brady, who's the ranking Republican on the Ways and Means Committee. And I called up Kevin and I said, hey, we tax the distilleries, the bourbon distilleries in Kentucky. It's called the federal excise tax on alcohol. And I said, these guys want to give away their alcohol to manufacture or create more and surge production of hand sanitizer. They don't even want to make a profit. They're just good citizens and they want to help. And, you know, the problem is that if they produce more alcohol, they're going to be taxed for it. Can you help? And he said, absolutely. This is a great idea. And he put in the bill, the CARES Act, he put in the bill a suspension of the federal excise tax for alcohol producers, distilleries. And so we solved that problem in the bill.
Good.
But then we still have the problem of the FDA.
Right.
And we still have the bureaucrats at the FDA who say, well, you know, we have two different types of alcohol. We have undenatured alcohol and denatured alcohol. And undenatured alcohol is fit for human consumption, and so we can't have that go into hand sanitizer. And I said, well, for you know, we're in a public health emergency.
Right.
No one's gonna be drinking hand sanitizer. They're gonna be putting it on their hands. Use some common sense.
Right.
We need hand sanitizer. People are not going to be drinking this. Put it in hand sanitizer. Let these people do it. They're going to do it for free. These are our people in Kentucky who want to help.
Yeah.
And, you know, the bureaucrats at the FDA are wringing their hands over this thing. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's totally ridiculous. So, I mean, I am happy to join my Democratic colleague from Louisville, John Yarmuth, and leading this letter, and we still don't have an answer from the FDA. It's just absurd.
Yeah.
It's absolutely absurd that bureaucrats in Washington are standing in the way of an obvious solution of our bourbon distillers saying, look, we will give our alcohol away to create more hand sanitizer.
This is no different than what's happening at automobile companies now, where, you know, Ford and GM and Tesla have partnered with GE to make respirators or ventilators. It's no different than the motor companies partnering with the government in the World War II to switch over from making, you know, Ford vehicles or Chevy vehicles to airplanes, you know, and hiring Rosie the River. It's no different. It's a thing that's an immediate need. And we have a bureaucracy that's standing in the way with it. We have grown-ass people that are eating Tide Pods, for goodness sakes, and they're not banning Tide. Why do they think that, you know, I can have if I want to, I can have a cabinet full of booze at home, and that's totally allowed, even though if I had a child, that child could potentially get into it. But, you know, I'm not being trusted as a parent to tell my kid, this is for your hands, not your mouth. I mean, it's absurd.
Well, look, and it's a temporary emergency. Let's lift the regulation for a temporary period of time. We all need hand sanitizer right now.
Right.
If we're running out, let's allow the distillers, the bourbon distillers, to give us some alcohol to put on our hands and clean ourselves during the pendency of this pandemic. I mean, it is very, very obvious. I think it is disgraceful. Right. That the FDA is standing in the way.
Yeah, no doubt. And I mean, it's not as if these bourbon distillers are going to say, hey, hand sanitizer is a great product. Let's just not make any more bourbon. I mean, when this is over, they're going right back to making bourbon. They are not going to keep making hand sanitizer.
That's right. And, you know, to the credit of the Kentucky distillers, they're not even trying to sell it.
Yeah, most of them. Yeah.
They're trying to give it away for free. They're trying to help.
Yeah.
And I just think it's absolutely disgraceful that a government bureaucrat would stand in the way of the Kentucky distillers trying to give away their product for free to help our frontline healthcare workers, keep them safe.
Yeah.
It is absolutely a disgrace. We are trying to push them to change this. I brought this up to the vice president yesterday, and also to Steve Scalise, the House Minority Whip, yesterday. And I hope we're going to make some progress on
this.
Yes,
that's awesome. I hope so, too. All right, a couple other things I want to cover here. First of all, what would a fourth stimulus bill actually look like? What should it look like? Are we talking more checks to people? Are we talking infrastructure, jobs to get people back to work once this is over? What does a fourth stimulus look like? What do you want it to look like? What do you think it will look like?
Well, the Paycheck Protection Program, the Small Business Loan Program, is obviously oversubscribed. We do need more money in that. And I actually think of all of the spending that we've done, this is the one that I think is the most justified, because what it does is it keeps employees connected to their employers. It keeps them on the payroll. And so that when we do reopen the economy, it will allow workers to be connected to their employers and restart the economy sooner. It allows people to avoid unemployment insurance and stay employed.
Right.
So I do think we do need to re-up that and make sure that an arbitrary limitation on appropriations is not limiting small businesses or their employees from having the support that they need. But But I think the priority and the focus, Leland, should be reopening the economy as soon as possible.
Yes.
And I know you've talked to our good friend Brian Gettle about this and other people. We need to reopen the economy as soon as possible, consistent with public health. And so anything and everything we have in a fourth phase should be focused on that. Number one, I think also what we need to do is we need to create a bipartisan, bicameral committee, an oversight committee investigating China. China's lies, China's cover up, China's unleashing this pathogen on the world. I think we need to investigate everything about the Chinese Communist Party and what they have done in terms of covering up what this pathogen that they created, what this has done for our global economy. And I also think that we should look into and investigate, what they did after this whole thing happened, which was that they hoarded personal protective equipment, and they're now gouging the global marketplace.
Yeah,
they have weaponized. Yeah. They have weaponized the supply chain.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, and we depend so much on them, and I hope that that's going to change in the future. I hope we can begin to wean ourselves from their cheap labor and move more towards great old American quality. Because I want to explore this a little bit, and I don't know if you've been catching up on your Netflix binge watching since you've been sequestered at home like everybody else, but there's a documentary called Pandemic that I'm about 5 of the 6 episodes into.
And I'm 2 in.
Are you 2 in? Oh my gosh, it's creeping me out because it came out like literally like a month or so before this whole thing sort of hit the fan. And one of the things that was interesting was it really stuck with me. They said over the last 50 years, and probably longer than that, but over the last 50 years for sure, every major virus problem has come from China. Over the last 50 years, every single major virus or flu-like outbreak around the world has come from China. At some point, we have to stop as a world community and go, hey, guys, what are you doing? You know what I mean? I mean, at some point, we got to be like, that has to be held accountable, you know, and I don't know why they're not.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so grateful that President Trump has called on cutting off funding to the World Health Organization that has covered this up for China and, basically supported China's lies in this whole process. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. And, you know, I think we need a very serious oversight effort. Our intelligence community needs to be involved. Our defense agencies need to be involved. Congress needs to be involved. We need an international investigation into China, into the origins of the COVID-19 pathogen. We need to investigate China's lies. We need to investigate China's cover-up. We need to investigate China's subsequent hoarding of personal protective equipment and what they're doing to gouge, countries that have been infected by this China virus. I heard a senior member of the military call this worse than a nuclear bomb going off in one of our major cities. This is war.
Yeah.
This is war. And we absolutely need to investigate this, and we need to hold China accountable.
I'm seeing reports that, you know, they believe firmly now, at least several major news outlets do anyway, that this virus did, in fact, originate from a lab in Wuhan. Not that China made it. Not that they created it as a bioweapon, but rather that they mishandled it when trying to study it. But the problem was, as I think all governments do this, but specifically and especially communist and socialist governments do this more than any, and that is that they're afraid of a problem happening because government is the ultimate moral authority, right? I mean, communist and socialist states set up government as superseding God in terms of power and moral authority and purity. So any mistake that happens by government can't be talked about, must be silenced, must be shuttered. When there was a doctor early on in this, a Chinese doctor early on in this that warned people, they threatened to imprison him for warning people that this is going to happen. exactly as always happens with communist countries, the cover up is worse than the crime. How can we hold China accountable? I don't think the world would have been all that angry if China came and said, hey, we were trying to find a cure for this new disease that was about to jump to humans. And guess what? It jumped to humans. We need help, right? That would have been the respectable thing to do on the world stage at that time. And probably this never would have gone beyond the city of Wuhan. Would have saved Chinese lives, would have saved American lives, Italian lives, everyone's lives. But they didn't. How do we hold them accountable? Is there a way to actually hold them accountable, short of war, because nobody wants that? But is there a way to actually physically hold them accountable for what they've done?
Well, Leland, I think sanctions is a big part of it. I think also we need to look at, reorienting our supply chain. We need to bring back all of the production capacity back to the United States and our allies. I was on the phone with Admiral Polochek yesterday. He is the White House Coronavirus Task Force lead with FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, in terms of the supply chain, in charge of the supply chain. And what he told us was quite alarming. 80% of the supply chain for medical equipment and personal protective equipment is outside of the United States. We've got to bring that home. Wow. We've got to bring back and repatriate to the United States critical medical infrastructure. I think that not only helps secure the United States, but it also punishes China for what they've done to the international community with this terrible virus. They have weaponized this virus.
Yeah, no doubt. That's, it concerns me because of the sheer cost that this has all had to the world. You know what I mean? I mean, the cost of all the economy shutting down. How do you do that, though? It's easy to say bring the supply chain back home to America. But, the largest mask maker in America is cranking out these masks for 10 cents a piece. China does it for 2 cents. And that mask maker, based in Dallas, Texas, is not running 24 hours a day right now. They did it during the swine flu, and they got screwed because the government would like the, wanted them to run 24/7. They ran 24/7. And then as soon as the epidemic passed, the hospital stopped ordering from them because they could get them for 2 cents from China. Now we don't have any, and these guys are like, well, we're not going to run 24/7 because as soon as this is over, you're going to do the same thing, and then I'm going to have to fire my employees again. So how do we, it's easy to say bring that supply chain home. How do we actually do it when labor costs so much more here and businesses are reticent to do it because of what's happened in the past?
Well, it's a good question. I think we need to work with our allies. I mean, I think, look, we have allies so we can have international supply chains that don't involve our enemies.
Right.
And
okay.
China has demonstrated through this crisis and other issues that they are not our friend. They are not our ally.
Right.
And I believe in international exchange. I believe in trade. I believe in, providing the lowest cost production and manufacturing. But we need to do that with our friends and our allies. And we don't need to be so over-dependent on countries like China, communist regimes that are clearly not for our own interest.
Well, we could. I mean, literally tomorrow, China, if they wanted to, could cut off almost every medication that any American is on, and that'd be the end of it. And we don't have a way to get around that. So you're absolutely right. It's got to be dealt with. And I think maybe after all of this is over, maybe that's what countries will do, and they'll recognize this. You're concerned about the debt too, though. I know that you're supportive of the stimulus packages. How do we deal with that? We were talking before we even went on the air. I was like, you know what? The debt, when I started talking about the debt when the Tea Party came out, was about $9 trillion. The first two or three rounds of stimulus were $6 trillion, two-thirds of that. Now we're talking about another one that could cost another $2 or $3 trillion. How do we control debt when this is over without crashing everything?
I just want to be as direct and candid with you and my constituents as I can be. I'll tell you, my greatest regret, I've been in Congress now for 8 years, and my single greatest regret is that, and I ran I ran. You and I talked about this before I was even a member of Congress. My purpose in running for Congress was to reduce the national debt, to cut a wasteful spending, to save America from bankruptcy. And I'll tell you, I mean, on that count, we have not done the job for the American people. And this is concerning. I mean, I tell you, it is heart-wrenching to me that we have to do this on the credit card of the American taxpayer. It is just absolutely it's absolutely heartbreaking. But I'll tell you what, I think we can. There are solutions to this, and I think what at the end of this whole process, I think what we should do is we should tabulate the whole pandemic, and we should segregate every cost of this pandemic, and we should encourage the American people to purchase pandemic bonds, just like we did during World War II. We encouraged the American people, the patriotic American people, to buy bonds, war bonds. We can do the same thing with pandemic bonds. We can encourage the American people to buy pandemic bonds and finance that through a revenue source, and then push those bonds out for 30 years and encourage the American people to finance this, but keep this off of the national debt.
Yeah, that's an interesting potential solution. All right, last thing before I let you go, because I know we're in a hurry here. When are we going to open up for business? I think if we go much past May 1st, we're really going to be screwed. I think if we can open up at least in stages and maybe in geographical areas that aren't being hit as hard, I think we can maybe save this thing. When do you think it's going to happen?
Well, I agree with President Trump that the cure cannot be worse than the disease. I also respect Tony Fauci, the director of the NIH, who's been a steady hand and guided us through this in terms of social distancing and everything. And I think I don't think that they're incompatible. I think we can reopen the economy without jeopardizing public health when we get on the back end of this. What is the back end? The back end is soon. And what it means is we're on the back end of the curve. And what that means is daily, consistent, regular, repeated declines in new cases. So once we start seeing, a week of continuous declines in new cases, what that means is that we can start reopening the economy, especially in those places where we don't have outbreaks.
Right.
I think what the president and the Congress should look to is the American Enterprise Institute has published a great paper. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, who is the former FDA commissioner, has put out a really good paper called Reopening, the Path to Reopening, or the Road to Reopening. And it involves making sure that we have more robust testing and a sentinel surveillance system, so better, more complete data collection, and then mitigation and containment. We can do this, and especially when we get some of these antivirals and therapies online, which are in the works right now, thanks to the American Free Enterprise System. I think that within a few weeks, we will be starting to reopen gradually and with a sentinel surveillance system under the guidelines that the American Enterprise Institute has laid out, we can get this economy going again.
I think that would be fantastic. And that's good news to hear, because if we could do that and turn the corner, I think maybe things could be salvaged from all of this and fewer people would die, because literally an economic collapse that we're facing if we don't do that could kill more people than this virus. Congressman Andy Barr, it's always great talking to you. Thanks so much for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Hey, Leland, thanks a lot. Stay healthy, everyone, and we're going to get through this. I'm very optimistic. Our country is resilient. The American people are resilient. We're going to be stronger on the backside of this, and both our healthcare system, our national security, and our economic situation is going to be stronger in the long run.
You got toilet paper?
yeah, every chance we get. I'll tell you what, Carol, I delegate that to Carol. Carol is the hero of my household, my wife. She's the hero. She goes every Sunday morning and she gets the toilet paper. So appreciate her.
Awesome. Congressman Barr, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks
all
a
right,
lot.
Bye bye. I always ask everybody that. We got toilet paper. So A couple things. First of all, the pandemic bonds. I hadn't even thought of that. It's actually a pretty decent idea. One way. Another way is we could charge China for the cost. I mean, I don't know how you actually extract that from China, but we could trade debt that we owe to China for the cost they inflicted on us from this for their lack of transparency. That could be a negotiating point for the president going forward in any future trade deals. So there you go. I mean, I think that could be very interesting. A couple of things I just thought were also interesting on a side note. We didn't talk a whole lot about the media with Congressman Barr, but ABC ran a report that the Pentagon had warned President Trump back in November about the pandemic potential. And HotWire.com has a story about this. The Pentagon has come out and said, no, that's not true. So yet again, another mainstream media outlet, ABC being one of them that's done this several times, runs with a completely fake news story. Now, I've got a lot of liberal friends that are still chattering about this, and I have to keep correcting them. I'm like, no, the Pentagon did not warn Trump in November about this. From the Hot Air piece, not only is it rare for intelligence agencies to issue public comments on its operation, it's even rarer for them to do so and claim that they missed a major issue. In other words, by the Pentagon coming forward and correcting ABC's story, they're actually admitting that they missed it, that we all missed this. And that's rare. Intelligence agencies usually don't do that. They don't usually admit a mistake. I mean, now it's an interesting juxtaposition compared to with how China, the communist state, is handling this, where they're covering every mistake up. And it's interesting that the Pentagon's come out and said, hey, actually, we missed this. No, we didn't warn the president. ABC News yesterday claimed, or earlier this week claimed, that the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is part of the Pentagon, had warned the White House about coronavirus in late November. The alleged report from the National Center for Medical Intelligence, NCMI, based on wire and computer intercepts, focused on the threat to U.S. forces in the Asia theater. This, again, is from the Hot Air piece. Hot Air writes, there's only one problem. The NCMI late yesterday, they've looked all over for this alleged document, and it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. Anonymous sources also told CNN that other intelligence agencies were tracking the information, but that the date of their first report wasn't clear. However, the CNN report, they noted that the information didn't make it into the presidential daily briefing for weeks. So, no, he wasn't warned about this ahead of time. And there's the media doing all this. It's fascinating to me because I was talking to somebody about this last night. The media doesn't do what it's designed to do. It was supposed to hold our leaders accountable, and I have no problem with that, questioning Trump and all that kind of stuff. But they're not doing it to hold leaders accountable. They're doing it to win elections. So their whole policy has shifted. They're covering the coronavirus. That's an important thing to do. But the way they're covering it is, how can we win for our ideological side? That's the only way that they're covering it. That does a complete disservice to America as a whole, right? We need to be in this together. We need to be this left or be in this left or right. It doesn't matter. That documentary Pandemic, that at one point they were talking about the swine flu outbreak or the bird flu or whatever it was in India some years ago. And the doctor said, look, the public can't handle this on its own. The government can't handle this on its own. Scientists can't handle this on their own. We all three have to work together. You cannot do that when the vast majority of the media apparatus in the country is trying to win an election for the Democrats, when the Democrats are trying to win an election for themselves, and when the President of the United States is just trying to get us through a crisis. We have to come together. We can't just give lip service to unity. We have to actually do it. This is a crisis. Put your politics aside. Forget trying to blame who started this. When did the president know? And when did he know? Stop it. We're trying to get through this as quickly as we can and get to the other side where we can all go back to work. And then one other thing I wanted to point out, just based on what Congressman Barr and I were saying, and I think he's dead on when he talks about how important it is that we get back to business. I think if we're not starting to open up sectors of the economy on May 1st, we're done. But I think we will be. And I think this is how it should work. And I've said this multiple times. I'm going to keep saying it. So pardon me if I sound repetitive, but I think it's important. The way you reopen. He mentioned the surveillance system that would allow us to sort of keep a close eye on when and where outbreaks are taking place of this virus. You would have masks for everyone. You would have testing available, okay? And you would have temperature testing available as well. And so you could say to a business, all right, May 1st, show us your 6-foot apart plan for all your customers. Show us that you're going to take your employees' temperature every day when they come into work. And show us that weekly you're going to test them for COVID-19. And if you can do those things, you can open up for business. Now, to everyone else, if you are, say, under the age of 60, you're in fairly good health, and you don't have any underlying conditions that could cause your immune system to be compromised, go ahead. Go to work. If you don't have it, go to work. Or if you have had it and you've recovered, go to work. Okay? Those of you that are over 60, those of you that have immune compromised, stay home for a little while longer. We'll bring you what you need, right? And then in a few more weeks, when we know we've got the capacity for PPE and the capacity for the beds and the respirators or whatever, if another wave comes, then we can say to them, if you want to, go ahead and go. And then so on and so forth. And you can sort of have a tapered release back into business. And you could also do this geographically, right? For the wide swaths of middle America that are on the downside of this and not experiencing what New York experienced, you could say go back to business for the most part. And for those places that are experiencing high concentrations of it, you could say, hold on, y'all need to stick around the house for a little bit longer. But if we set some dates and say on May 1st, we're going to go here if we have these benchmarks met, that gives hope. That gives a sense of something to work toward. It gives businesses a sense of assurance. It gives them an idea. Well, if I get one of these small business plans, how long will it float me? Oh, May 1st? Okay, I'm good. I can do that, right? It will change the makeup of how we're thinking about all of this. It will give us something to work together. As I said in a previous episode, rallying points are important. If we don't have a rallying point, this virus will beat us. But if we have rallying points, even if we miss them because we weren't quite where we needed to be, we still will have the hope from those rallying points, and we've got to have them. And just one other point on that. One thing that I am notating from all of this is I'm hearing anecdotally and seeing in some articles, our hospital capacity is not even being close to being breached in most of the United States. And in fact, in many parts of the United States, nurses, doctors, et cetera, are being sent home and furloughed because there isn't enough work for them. Because what happened, and this is one of the areas where the cure was worse than the disease, we told all the hospitals in the country, no more elective surgeries. Well, guess what? A lot of rural hospitals that don't have a huge amount of demand for like triage and trauma and emergency or whatever, they make their money off of elective surgeries. So now we have a lot of people in America that are going through pain they shouldn't have to go through. You know, that bum knee and they can't get it replaced, bum hip and they can't get it replaced. You know, minor surgeries that could be outpatient, done in a day, whatever. You need doctors and nurses for that. Those doctors and nurses have been home. That revenue source has dried up, and those hospitals are sitting 50% instead of 100%. That is a problem that we did not foresee, right? And then there's other places in the country where it is a very real problem that the healthcare system is being overrun, like in New York, like what I think might be about to happen in the next 2 or 3 days in Florida and other places. So the way we need to take stock of this and recognize, wait a minute, maybe we can go ahead and tell hospitals, go ahead and get some revenue from some elective surgeries, because that'll keep you busy. And just keep in mind that you may have to cancel those surgeries if you have a surge. I mean, it doesn't seem like rocket science, but that's something else that kind of needs to play into the whole discussion here. Anyway, all right, I digress. I promised you that we would not talk about coronavirus all week, and here it is Thursday. And we've basically talked about coronavirus all week. But tomorrow's Friday, and I have a plan to do a special Good Friday message that will, of course, have some coronavirus undertones. But I am going to make a huge effort next week to get us some topics in here that are not coronavirus related, because we all need a break from it. And Cameron Mills is going to join us on that as well. The best thing you can do to help me is to spread this podcast around. You know, we don't want to spread the virus, but we do want to spread the message. So spread this podcast around by asking your friends to subscribe to it. Tell them how awesome and fun it is. And you can subscribe for free at Apple Podcasts, at Google Play, at Spreaker, and at iHeartRadio's app. Just search The Disruption Zone and we'll come right up. And you can tell it to just send my new episodes directly to your phone. And that way you can carry me around in your pocket. Thanks to my co-host and co-executive producer, who will be back with us next week for a few episodes, Cameron Mills. Thanks to Dynamics Productions in Lexington for their help and support of the production side of this program, including the music that you hear. DXAudio.com for all your production needs. And thank you. Thank you for listening. We are literally getting thousands of downloads a week now. And I can't even begin to tell you how thankful I am that you have chosen to give me this voice. In the absence for now of a terrestrial radio platform It is heartwarming that you guys still want to hear from me, and I appreciate that more than words can say. And so the thousands of downloads a week that are coming into this program are just phenomenal, and you touch my heart. Thanks again for listening. I am Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.